engines.
Right now we're at Big Night in Little Haiti.
Big Night, Little Haiti.
We're enjoying the music at Big Night, Little Haiti.
You are listening to WLRN 91.3 FM.
And indeed, it is WLRN FM 91.3 on this Monday afternoon. Joseph Cooper here, along with Bonnie Berman. You just back from your trip to California. How'd that go?
It went great.
Good.
Yeah.
Well, we missed you.
Well, thank you. I missed you.
Well, this hour we visit with psychologist and consultant Dr. Catherine Steiner Adair. She's a Harvard clinical instructor and author of The Big Disconnect, Protecting Childhood and Family Relationships in the Digital Age. And she joins us from one of my favorite towns, Tennant's Harbor, Maine. Welcome to you, Doctor.
Thank you so much.
What's Tennant's Harbor like?
Today it is a little foggy, but you know what they say about the weather in Maine. If you don't like it, it will change in 5 minutes. It is as peaceful and calm and quiet and luscious as you could imagine the Maine coast would be. I'm staring at three great blue herons now who are having feeding time in our mud flat.
Well, let's wrap this program up at 2 o'clock, and Bonnie and I will be coming up to see you.
Yeah, it sounds beautiful.
Great.
So, Doctor, I'm thinking families confronted change in the home with the advent of the telephone and then the television. So how does the digital revolution compare in terms of changing the landscape?
Well, it compares, you know, pretty in a parallel way in that this is the latest new technological revolution, but it doesn't compare, or it's sort of exponentially quite different in that you can't take a television in your back pocket with you, and parents could control pretty much what forms of technology their kids had access to and where they were going on TVs, especially when we only had three channels instead of 999 channels. And children's use of telephones or TVs was home-based, and parents could keep track of where their kids were roaming, if you will, and all of that has changed.
I grew up after schools watching things like the Three Stooges and Heckle and Jekyll, and they were certainly pretty violent things. I don't think I suffered from it a couple hours a day.
There's a difference between kids watching cartoons, although the research now shows even watching cartoons like SpongeBob can make kids not more violent in the sense of shoot 'em up violent, but more aggressive. A little more quick to be impulsive, and there's a huge difference between watching the Three Stooges and playing Call to Duty, where you are playing a video game where blood is splatting on your screen, and you are actively engaged in pulling triggers and blowing people up. And you know, again, the issue isn't so much whether we've seen a spike in mass shootings, which we are, not only are we seeing more of them, but we are seeing them more, which is very important. Whenever there's a shooting now, whenever there's an act of violence, kids and everybody sees it in every taxi, over and over and over, the replay, 24/7. So what we are seeing, both from the instant exposure and the repeated exposure, plus the different content in video games, is a desensitization to violence, as well as some increases in some kids' aggressive behaviors.
What are the brain synapse implications of too much of this digital input, particularly of a violent nature?
Oh, boy, you know, that is just such a good question. One of the tricky things is that we have adapted more quickly than we have been able to research. So, you know, a helpful analogy, not to sound too scary, but is cigarette smoking. You know, along came this thing. It was really cool. It looked cool. It was social, etc. And then, you know, 25 years later, 30 years later, we understand that it's lethal. So we're just now beginning to understand and do some research, although it's still hard to do, on the impact of computer and technologies with children of different ages and adults of different ages. And what we do know is that there are certain risk factors for people becoming addicted, and there are risk factors for people being enticed maybe to act in ways they wouldn't otherwise. Certainly, if you have an impulsive personality or ADD-type wiring, you are more likely to become addicted, if not dependent. You know, there are stages. There's like you play games, you've got a kid. One child can play a computer game, get on and off without having a meltdown. You've got another child, same family, who's got different neurological wiring, and you tell them, honey, time to get off the game, and they don't. And you tell them again, and they don't. And then when they get off, they are angry and agitated and sulky. You know, and that child has different wiring. And if you know already that you've got a child who prones or tends towards impulsivity and towards attentional issues, they're going to have a much harder time making the transitions in and out of the screen, and they're going to be more vulnerable to getting locked into the screen in ways that are going to be harder to control.
Doctor, you're particularly concerned about children and their relationships with their families.
Mm-hmm.
Is that because of the parents' digital involvement or that of the children or both? Because I'm thinking how, you know, children must see their parents as very hypocritical if they're glued to their tablet or their iPhone or their computer screen and they're told not to.
You bet. That is the word that came up over and over and over. It seemed like there was a threshold at about 11 where kids really knew that word and they use it all the time.
My hypocritical, you mean?
Hypocrite. Yeah, my mom's such a hypocrite. My dad's such a hypocrite. You know, they say we're going on vacation. They're so excited to have family time. And then my dad brings his stupid computer to the beach. You know, or my mom says no computer, no telephones at the dinner table. And all of a sudden she's texting with her sister. And, you know, what's up with that? And so often children talk about not only their frustration with their parents being hypocritical, but they talk with a lot of sadness. And some in some cases, a hopelessness about having to compete for their parents' attention with the computer screen or a smartphone screen. And they talk about and describe to me a kind of relationship fatigue.
Is this, you know, further? Mom, I'm sorry, go ahead.
You know, they get sort of frustrated and then give up. They give up. Mom, get off your phone. I'm going to be late. Mom, get off your phone. Mom, come on. No. And, no, darling, 1 minute. This is important. It's for work. And then, you know, kids go plug into their own screen while they're waiting. But that giving up on parents and the message kids describe getting from their parents is worrisome to me. Yeah.
Is this further eroding the old tradition of a family dinner time meal when the family sat down to share a meal and we could say, well, Catherine, what did you learn at school today, and talk about things?
Well, in many families, that's, you know, pretty eroded already, but yes, it is. I mean, you know, you don't, for families, dinner, when you do get to eat dinner as a family, that is when we say, what, you know, who do you sit next to at lunch today? What do you guys talk about? What did you learn? What was hard? What was good? You know, some families have a ritual. Everybody go around and say the best part of their day. Everybody say the most frustrating or challenging part of their day. And it's in those conversations that not only do we connect as families, but we practice critical relationship skills, taking turns, listening, reflecting back to somebody what you heard them say. And it's where we create the fabric of our family, if you will. And when those conversations are interrupted by texting or taking a call or a computer at the table or someone's eyes diving under the table to look at their screen, it is disruptive and it is jarring and it is hurtful to children. They don't like it.
When you were talking about children feeling that sense of hopelessness about not being able to get their parents' attention because their parents are so busy with their digital outlet, whatever it is, what percentage in your research, what percentage of children, I mean, it's funny to think that children would be hearkening back to the good old days when, before technology, what percentage of the children had that hopelessness?
A lot of them did. A lot of them did. And in fact, they used language just like the language you used. You know, I kind of wish it was like the good old days when families mattered more. Several kids said that. Or older children would say, I feel really badly for my six-year-old brother because now when he goes on a family vacation, it's so different from when I went on a family vacation 12 years ago because Dad didn't have a smartphone. And when he said we were going to go skiing together, we skied and we talked on the ski lift. He wasn't texting the office on the ski lift. So kids are very aware, very aware. And the good news is that kids want to be with their parents. They want family time. They want to feel like their parents want to be with them.
We're speaking with Dr. Catherine Steiner-Adair. She's an internationally recognized Harvard clinical psychologist, school consultant, and author. And her book is The Big Disconnect, Protecting Childhood and Family Relationships in the Digital Age. We're on Topical Currents with a short break, and we'll be right back.
This is Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station, and NPR for the Florida Keys, 91.5 WKWM. We're funded by listeners like you and by ConservArt, offering professional restoration and conservation of fine art and collectibles for over 50 years. Custom framing and insurance claims handling are specialties. More information is online at conserveart.net.
Hi, I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson.
We are the hosts of NPR's Here and Now, now heard Monday through Thursday at 2 p.m.
It's a news magazine designed to keep you up to date with the day's news.
And introduce you to amazing people far from the headlines.
It's Here and Now with Jeremy Hobson, that's me.
And Robin Young.
That's her.
Monday through Thursday at 2 p.m. here on South Florida's NPR news station, 91.3 WLRN.
And NPR for the Florida Keys, 91.5 WKWM.
You can find Topical Currents on Facebook, a dedicated page with daily program descriptions, links to our guests, authors, and books. Facebook.com/topicalcurrents.
And indeed, we are returning. Topical Currents. We will have links to Dr. Catherine Steiner-Adair book, The Big Disconnect, at both the Topical Currents Facebook page and also at our website, WLRN.org. Tell me, Dr. Catherine Steiner-Adair, how can parents lessen digital influence without seeming to be overly restrictive in the eyes of kids and their peers?
Well, I think every family should have some kind of understanding about what your family's values are about when to use technology and what's okay and where to go. And now that everyone's getting ready to go back to school, it's a good time to come up with what, you know, many schools and families call a responsible use contract or understanding, and really sit down with your kids in a pretty calm way and say, you know, here's this phone. This phone's a privilege. Here's what, you know, I think it should be used for. What do you think it should be used for? Do you think it's okay to send mean texts about other people or forward gossip? Or, you know, and really talk about what are good manners and what's digital citizenship and what matters to you as parents. Write it up, have everybody sign it, and then you have a foundation to refer back to when kids make mistakes, and they're going to make mistakes, and they're going to end up on websites you don't want them on. And then I think what's really important is how you respond. And it's very important to be calm, and especially when you come across really trashy language, because chances are that Several things are at play when your kids use edgy language that certainly isn't language you use at home. One thing is it's probably something they either picked up online, or it could be a lyric from a song or something they saw on a YouTube video. So before you freak out, it's always better just to say, gee, where did you come up with this language? Because certainly we don't talk this way. Help me understand how you ended up posting this. And then, you know, talk about it. And up until about the age of 11, 10 or 11, you should be able to pretty much have a fairly good sense of control over what your kids are doing online and where they're going. But in middle school, it gets more challenging because they can outwit you, most parents. But you can set up some very good controls with Safety Net, with Net Nanny. Common Sense Media is a wonderful website to go to help you figure out what kind of controls you want to put and limits you want to put into your kids' technology and limits you want to put in their access to technology. And then we have to talk about it every day, just like we talk about relationships and life. This is a part of life now, and we have to be more active as parents discussing, what did you do online today? Where did you go? Who did you hang out with?
If you'd like to speak to Dr. Catherine Steiner Adair, her book is entitled The Big Disconnect, Protecting Childhood and Family Relationships in the Digital Age. You can call us at 1-800-743-9576. That's 1-800-743-9576. You can email us, radio@wlrn.org, or you can tweet us at Topical Currents. Doctor, if you don't mind my asking, I noticed you had two children, and I'm just wondering how you dealt with the technology with them and if you would have done anything differently.
Oh, I would have done so many things differently. That's part of what motivated me to write the book, honestly. My 28-year-old son just rode the wave of each new form of technology as they came in, and he is one of these young men who is very, very computer savvy and loves to write code and loves computer games and really did some amazingly creative programming and stuff with computers. But we were so new to computers and didn't know or understand what we were actually dealing with when the first, you know, computer games came into play, and he loved it unambivalently, and my husband and I had sort of a love-hate relationship with the computer. For me, I felt, on the one hand, thrilled with my son's skill and the learning he was doing, the fun he was having with his friends, but I really didn't like at all how hard it was to get him off his computer. Or I felt like, you know, family fun was in competition now in a very different way with computer games than it had been with anything else. And looking back, there are a whole bunch of things I would do differently.
In your book, you talk about that kids 8 to 18 spend an average of 7 hours per day on some form of digital device. Is this contributing to youngsters' obesity by restricting their outdoor activities?
Well, it is in two different ways. It's definitely making kids more sedentary, but another way in which it's contributing to obesity is that there's a lot of junk food advertising that's linked to a lot of computer games and apps. So the marketers for the unhealthy food that's very easily accessed in our culture are all over apps and kids' games. In fact, many apps are tied to junk food products. So it's both the sedentary aspect of it and the branding that kids are very vulnerable to.
And what other ways do you think the outdoors contribute to development that children that are not any longer going for, you know, playtime or outdoor activities are being deprived?
Oh, well, you know, just think about it. Think about what it was like when you played dress-up. You know, I don't know about you guys, but I had this crate, you know, a big box full of old clothes that my mom had tossed out, and my dad's oversized shoes and high heel shoes, my mother and boas, and you know, all sorts of odds and ends. And the physicality of playing dress up is actually quite wonderful. It's kinesthetically very engaging. Then there's the narrative that goes along with it. You're making up a story, and then you change the story, and then you add to the story. That's called deep play. It's very important for kids' intellectual and creative development. And then there's the social interaction. Oh, you be this person, and I'll be that person. So you're really developing social and emotional interactive skills and the capacity to co-create with somebody else. That is so different in every possible way than playing dress-up on a dress-up game online. You know, the physicality is you move your index finger. You don't generate any of the narrative or pick the clothes. It's like red tiara, green tiara, purple tiara. You know, I mean, mm-hmm. there's just no comparison. Or you play a pickup game of baseball with kids. You're arguing, you're fighting, who's safe, who's out, what the rules are. You are learning so much about teamwork, about leadership, about negotiating conflict, about having fun and hanging out together. Well, that's very different from playing baseball online or playing with a Wii game. I mean, it's fun, but it's not the same kind of fun. And for young children especially, the sensorium, that part of the brain, needs to be engaged physically, kinesthetically, creatively, generating its own material for play. And when kids play on computer, everything is just, you know, given to them, quick, fast, etc.
Our telephone number, if you'd like to join in our conversation, that's easy enough, 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN. Also, email, that's radio@WLRN.org, and also Twitter, that's @TopicalCurrents. First caller, Boca Raton, this is Juan. Hi there.
Hi, thanks for letting me ask this question. I wanted to ask what would you tell parents that say that technology is the future and that it's important for them to be immersed in technology because it will help their career or whatnot or how to get along in the future?
Well,
and I'll take your answer off the air. Thank you. Sorry about that.
Sure. Well, I would say that there's a time and a pace for growing up. And, of course, technology is the future, and it's here to stay. But having your child play too much with technology and be engaged too much with technology is not going to give them a jump start. If anything, the risk is that it will hinder them. And we know, for example, that the absolute best way, hands down, for children in the first 5 years of life to develop pre-literacy skills, the ability to speak, to follow conversation, to listen, to love language, to want to read, is by being read to by a human being. And sure, you know, a book on tape is second best, but it is not the same. And babies, infants, we know now from using technology, infants respond very differently to the physical experience of sitting in somebody's lap or at circle time on the floor and being read a book than they do to hearing a book or a book on a videotape. They retain the language better. So if you want your infant or your toddler to have a good vocabulary and good pre-literacy skills, don't listen to the misleading false advertising of so many of these baby app, baby brilliant computer, quote, technologies that will give your child a boost. A lot of it is false advertising, so much so, in fact, that Susan Lin, who runs the Campaign for a Commercial-Free Childhood, has made a complaint to the FTC against Fisher-Price and Homer for false advertising, just like with the Baby Einstein product. So your kids will learn technology. They're going to learn technology in school. They're going to learn everything they need to learn. And as you get older, it's very easy to adapt and catch up.
So
you
what?
Cannot
I'm
regain.
Sorry.
You can't make up for the lost early years playing, being read to, playing in your own imagination, developing the capacity to be bored, to work through boredom, to frustration, to get to figure out what you want to do, self-generated play. Those are very important skills that technology cannot give your child.
Well, I wanted to ask you what age we should start giving these technology to our children, but we need to take a short break. We're speaking with Dr. Catherine Steiner-Adair, and she's a Harvard clinical psychologist. Her latest book, The Big Disconnect, Protecting Childhood and Family Relationships in the Digital Age. And when we come back, we'll ask that question. Stay with us.
This is Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station, and NPR for the Florida Keys, 91.5 WKWM. We're funded by listeners like you and by Becker and Polyakov, proud to support WLRN and celebrating 40 years of service to their clients and communities. You can learn more at bplegal.com. That's bplegal.com. WLRN listeners are educated, affluent, savvy consumers. If these are the people your business is trying to reach, consider becoming a WLRN program underwriter. Listeners learn about your business and that you care about the future of public radio. Learn more by calling Michael Payton at 305-350-7978.
Broward College Fort Lauderdale Speaker Series begins its inaugural season at the Broward Center with seven fascinating evenings. Speakers include economist and publisher Steve Forbes, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., Bob Woodward, Soledad O'Brien, author Jeanette Walls, oceanographer Jean-Michel Cousteau, and presidential historian Michael Beschloss. Information and subscriptions at the Broward Center at 954-462-0222 or online at fortlauderdalespeakerseries.com.
And welcome back to today's Topical Currents, Monday edition. Bonnie Berman here with Joseph Cooper, and we're speaking with Dr. Catherine Steiner-Adair. She's a Harvard clinical psychologist and school consultant, and her book is The Big Disconnect. And we have some callers, but as I said before the break, Doctor, at what age do you suggest parents allow their children access to screens? I've personally seen to get a kid quiet if they take them out to dinner or whatever. These infants, they're giving them screens, tablets.
Well, the American Pediatric Association strongly recommends that infant to two-year-olds not be given screens at all. And that between 3 and 5, half hour to an hour is fine, especially if it is educationally sound content. It is not a good idea to use a smartphone to calm a child down when they are fussing in the takeout line or at a restaurant or on a plane, because in effect what you are doing is you are not teaching a child to calm themselves down. You are teaching them that the way you deal with being frustrated and impatient is to get more stimulated.
Mm.
And that is neurologically not a good thing to do. And, but, you know, think of what we do with our babies. We hold them, we soothe them, we sing to them. The capacity to calm yourself down is a critical life skill. If the only way a child can deal with frustration, boredom, anger, being upset, is to plug into a screen, you are setting the stage for a child to be very compromised in their flexibility and adaptability later on.
Hmm.
And let's take a few more telephone calls. This is Joe. He's in Delray. Hi there.
Hi, how are you? Dr. Steiner, I just got into your conversation just now when I turned the radio on, but it's a subject that I feel very strongly about, and I happen to concur with you almost verbatim on how you feel about it. And the point I'd like to make is, first, I'd like to quote Albert Einstein when he said that it had become quite apparent our technology was far surpassing our humanity. And mm-hmm. I believe in that sense, Children are not being encouraged to read books. They're not being encouraged to continue to use their imaginations from reading. They're looking for immediate gratification from a machine or from the technology which is available. Parents need to use the same caution that they did with TV usage, you know, not allowing kids to just watch as much TV as they like. I firmly believe that, you know, we're forgetting how to write letters. We're going to forget how to speak with each other. We're going to forget how to interact with people face to face.
Doctor?
Well, you know, I worry about whether our technology is trumping and preceding and surpassing our humanity. And so did a lot of the actual teenagers and young adults that I spoke with. I heard over and over again comments like, you know, it's really ironic, we're the most connected generation ever, and yet we're really bad at intimacy. And there's this big disconnect, if you will, between the capacity to text really rapidly and the ability to call up a friend and say, oh, I'm so upset. Oh, I got to talk. Do you have 5 minutes? And one of the things that's happened most recently that concerns me is that we no longer use telephones to listen to each other. I date myself. You know, there used to be that ad, reach out and touch someone for Yellow Pages, mm-hmm. and the telephone. And really what we were talking about is if we couldn't be with you, if I can't be with you, you know, in real life, right there with you, my tone of voice and my ability to listen to you and be there with you in this most uniquely human way of communicating would be the next best thing. And now many teenagers and young adults say, oh, I would never call anybody. Are you kidding? That's so awkward. A telephone call? Oh, no, then you have to deal with, like, a silence. Or, oh, that's so intense. That's intrusive. I would
and yet,
never.
Yet many families use Skype and video conferencing.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Skyping is wonderful.
Oh, okay.
You know, back to your question about at what age, I think Skyping for babies to Skype with their grandparents, divine. These are good things for grandparents to put on puppet plays, you know, across the country with their grandchildren, for cousins to be able to talk to each other. I think all of that is wonderful. Wonderful. And as a mom, I'm really happy to get that text from my kids, you know, the plane landed, I'm home, all's good, you know, whatever it is. So it's not that it's all bad, but are we allowing technology to connect us in some ways that are clearly gains, but what are we losing? I guess, you know, that's the other question. And I think with text, we're losing tone of voice. And I think we need to think about that.
It's amazing the dexterity that young people show. Mm-hmm. I was watching a cashier at the local supermarket, and she had her smartphone in her smock pocket, and she was texting blind.
Yeah. My 23-year-old daughter texts with her thumbs faster than I can type on my computer. She's so dexterous. She's so quick and fast. It is astonishing to me. Doesn't have to look at all what she's doing. And you know, they are the natives. They know how to do this.
Oh, yes.
It's in their bodies. It's in their brains. It's a very different way of interacting.
And we'll move along. Another caller from Boca Raton. This is Robert. Hi there.
Hi. Wonderful program. Dr. Steiner, two quick points. In addition to the fact that we don't chat, I find that a lot of millennials do not retain information. They know where to get it. They can Google it. Mm-hmm. But they don't do that. And then the other thing is, I see younger people, they tend to be expressionless. They don't register a lot of emotions. And that bothers me. And that also that you can sometimes tell somebody who is a fast texter by the way that they talk. It's incredibly fast. Mm-hmm. I'm going to show, you know, the fact that I underscore what you said about brain development and young children under the age of 12, you should not really put a child in front of a flat screen because they don't gain the spatial distance. We as humans don't get distance until we're about 2.5 years old. We judge distance by shadows and groping our hands out. And when we get older, you see young people driving, and they tend to tailgate a lot. They'll get right behind a car and then swerve around and turn. And part of that is, I think, is maybe they think they're doing a video game and they're not judging what that is. My last quick point is that it used to be that people in an audience or a meeting retained 30%. Now it's down to about 18. You can't put 300 adults on timeout for texting. So your words have to cover all the emotions. It's really difficult to be able to relate to all the generations, and I find it almost sad that young people are not. One other point. Now we don't say "I love New York." We say "I heart New York." There's a radio station that says "I heart such and such." The fear of getting close to somebody that might hurt us emotionally by rejecting love or whatever, and then we can unfriend somebody, all comes together with this lack of complete communication on all levels. And I think it's true what the other caller said, that technology is surpassing our humanity, what Einstein said.
Okay, Robert, thanks.
Interesting, Robert.
Thank
you.
We have to run.
Doctor?
Yes. Well, I guess what I would say is, you know, part of the reason I wrote the book was to get us all to sort of reboot or refresh or hit pause and really rethink. Are we becoming who we want to be with these tools? And are we relating to each other in the ways we want to? And I remain optimistic that we can regain control and we can correct our course and not have text wars when we are upset with somebody in our family and not use emoticons to express important sentiments of love and affection or, you know, anger and upset. I think that we have all fallen in love with technology. I think technology, you know, the siren call of the screen draws it into us, the interaction just between our brains and technology. But we are still capable of being in charge. And I hope that some of the things that are going on now, commonplace, unbelievably rude behaviors that 10 years ago just didn't exist, like being at a dinner table with somebody and suddenly picking up a phone and ignoring everybody around you and having a different conversation. Or, you know, I fly around the country a lot, and I am amazed at how somebody sitting next to me on a plane will start using really graphic, unpleasant, sometimes, you know, foul language about somebody they might have just interviewed, and they'll name their name, or somebody they work with, and they name their name, or they're having a horrible fight with somebody, and it's as if there's sort of an invisible phone booth around them, and nobody can hear all this highly personal information. I think that, you know, we've lost certain boundaries and kinds of civility, but I think we can reclaim them if we just step back and are more mindful and more aware that fundamentally we are connected to each other at a very human level, and we can't lose sight of that with this technology.
We're speaking with Dr. Catherine Steiner Adair, and she's a Harvard clinical psychologist. Her book, The Big Disconnect, on today's Topical Currents. More questions and your calls when we come back, our last break.
This is 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station, and NPR for the Florida Keys, 91.5 WKWM. Taking a quick look at weather, mostly cloudy skies. It is currently 86 degrees in Miami. We're funded by listeners like you and by Disability Rights Florida, providing protection and advocacy services to people with disabilities statewide for 35 years. Disability Rights Florida on the web at disabilityrightsflorida.org. Tune in to WLRN TV 17 on Saturday, August 31st at 8 p.m. for David Phelps Classic. A Grammy-winning tenor and well-known member of the Gaither Vocal Band, David Phelps takes us on a musical journey in this live concert event.
And it is today's topical currents, Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman and Dr. Catherine Steiner Adair. We're talking about her book, The Big Disconnect. Tell me, how does it affect any proclivity of young people to be more prone to aggressive behavior and also future addictions?
Aggressive behavior and future addictions. Okay. Well, we talked earlier in the show about how playing hours and hours and hours of violent, aggressive, and sexually aggressive video games desensitizes children and adults to violence. Not the large scale so much as more on a person-to-person level. So a lot of the discourse and conversations on social networking sites that kids hang out on, not the really cool intellectual sites they're on or where the sites where they're really generating some very good educational material or really furthering skills. I mean, they're wonderful things teenagers and tweens are doing online. But more on the social side of things, there's a very different ethos and sort of set of values on a lot of online culture. You know, we hear a lot about pretty bad cyberbullying that goes on, but there's also a sort of a overall tenor on a lot of social network exchanges that's sort of like a gotcha kind of game. And instead of, say, at home or at school, we say, think before you speak. A lot of the way kids interact online is to push send and say something edgy before even thinking about how that might feel on the other person who's the receiving end, especially when you don't see somebody and their reaction. It's much easier to take risks and say things like, you deserve to die, or, you're fat, you're ugly, the kinds of things that are pretty common. And there's a lot of sexual innuendo online that most kids would never play with in real life. And that's complicated because, we have a very funny situation right now in that our kids are growing up in a very sex-saturated culture. And they can find on YouTube all sorts of stuff and online all sorts of stuff. And in fact, many teens and tweens are getting their sex education, if you will, by going online. And a lot of it is pretty crass and ugly and misogynistic content. And yet at the same time, we sort of have this gag rule at many schools where we can't talk about healthy sexuality, love, real, sexual intimacy, really create the kinds of dialogues that teenagers benefit from enormously when they're in schools that provide those kinds of conversations. And what I hear a lot of, and was surprised, frankly, to hear a lot of in focus groups I did around the country, I interviewed over 1,000 kids, and beginning at around 11 and 12, boys would ask me questions like, Dr. Steiner Adair, can I just ask you a question? Like, I don't understand, why would a woman want to be choked while having sex? Mm. And, I would use it as a teachable moment and say, actually, a lot of what you see, I'd say, where did you see that? And they saw it on, porn or some kind of sexually misogynistic movie, but usually, some site online. And I would explain to them that those are role-playing and it's not real and people don't like that. And, but the amount of work it takes to unpack some of these things that kids are seeing is pretty critical. And we can't afford to be naive and think that our children aren't seeing things that are damaging to them. A lot of kids said to me, they didn't want to see stuff and left such a bad imprint in their little head, that totally either by mistake they got some porn pop-up or somebody sent them something thinking it would be really funny. And it was very, very upsetting. And, kids use the phrase like, I lost my innocence. And, you know, so the impact of this is, I think, greater than we know. There is a big disconnect between what parents think their kids are doing online and the extent to which parents feel like they are confident that their kids are fine online, and what kids are actually doing, and the extent to which kids are not telling their parents what they're doing online.
What do they do? They lie? They hide?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Uh-huh. They lie, or they drop their screens. The most common thing is, you know, kids will drop their screen when a parent walks in the room, and or they'll say, they'll just deny doing what they're doing, and about 25% of kids said their parents don't ask them what they're doing online. So, you know, that's a real eye-opener. Half the parents live under the assumption that their teens tell them everything that they do online. This is a study done by McAfee, who provide safety programs for families online. Well, half the parents live under the assumption that their teens tell them everything they do online, and the reality was that 70% of teens say their parents don't need to know everything they do online, and half of them also said that they'd really change what they do online if they thought their parents would find out or knew.
So, that's revealing.
Again, yeah, it is revealing.
We have an emailer, Dr. Miriam, would like to know if you have any suggestions. She's a single parent, but she was an absentee parent due to illness for years, but now she has a 14-year-old who's misusing the internet, and he resents her taking back her parenting status. Her illness has been resolved, and there's a lot of misuse of the internet. She wants to know if you have any suggestions.
We're also a little short on time.
I would say go to a counselor, go to a local family therapy clinic, and get someone to help you. Because it's really hard as a single parent to do this on your own, but your instinct is absolutely right. Your child will be mad at you. They'll feel like you're taking away their independence and their autonomy, but you're doing the right thing. And get somebody else in there with you who could be a third party to really facilitate that.
And a quick call. This is Lewis in Miami. Hi there. Lewis.
Oh, sorry. I couldn't hear. I have a comment about the net nanny programs. I'm 26 years old, and when I was 11 or 12, my parents, you know, put net nanny on my computer, and I just don't believe that these sort of programs work. Us as kids, we're very tech savvy, where we can figure out ways around these sort of programs. Figure out the password or other ways, proxies and things like that to, mm-hmm. you know, defeat the purpose of these net nanny softwares.
I think you're right. You know, up to middle school, they're helpful. And the other thing I would also say is it's really important for parents not to do this in a spyware kind of way, but to do it completely transparently. Say, look, I'm concerned. We're going to have certain safety guards on the internet. We're going to be looking, we're going to be reviewing with you where you're going. We're going to check your cookies. We're going to check your history. And you know that at a certain point, if kids want to, they can do an end run on that. That's why it's so important in elementary school and leading up to middle school to have the kinds of conversations you want to have. Now, that said, if your kids are getting into trouble and going places you don't want them to go, it's your job to pull the computer, take back the phone. These are privileges. These are not entitlements. You can make sure that they do their homework and use their technology for homework and educational things, and then just yank it. I'm so sympathetic to the sense of feeling out of control for parents, like you don't have the resources to know enough of what you need to know, that your kids are smarter than you, and after a certain point, that's true.
Right.
But,
well, we
but
certainly
that
want to thank
you. Doesn't mean you don't want to try and do your best.
Exactly. Well, and we have your book, Dr. Catherine Steiner Adair, Harvard clinical psychologist, and her book is The Big Disconnect: Protecting Childhood and Family Relationships in the Digital Age. We want to thank you so much for joining us today. It was very informative.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
And thanks for listening this hour. Our producer is Richard Ives. Technical direction, Caroline Brader-Watts. Paul Leary is online producer. We have free audio archives and program downloads at our website, WLRN.org. More information as well at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Drop us a like so your friends can find us as well. Tomorrow's program is with attorney and writer Linda Hirschman. She's written Victory, the Triumphant Gay Revolution. It's the story of a very small minority of individuals who made a societal revolution. And the calendar. On this day in 1907, 106 years ago, Harry Houdini escapes from underwater chains in just 57 seconds at San Francisco's Aquatic Park. And on this day in 1947, 66 years ago, hometown boy Yogi Berra is honored by the St. Louis Browns at the Old Sportsman's Park. The Yankee catcher began his remarks to the hushed summer crowd with this Yogiism: "I want to thank everyone for making this night necessary." One more while we head to the ninth. On this day in 1947, 66 years ago, a groundbreaking big league appearance of an African-American pitcher, Brooklyn's Dan Bankhead. He hit a home run in his first major league at bat, alas, his only one. So we leave with a thought from Yogi Berra, who also hit a homer in his first big league at bat. His wife of many years, Carmen, asked Yogi where he'd want to be buried. Yogi replied, "I don't know. Surprise me." This is Joseph Cooper for Bonnie Berman. Next, get into the here and now from NPR News.
This is 9.